This is Jamie Patrice Giovanno.
And this is Erica Nicole Griffin.
And we are reading our manuscript, From Emmett Till to the Rose Petal Cottage, Critical Pedagogy and Popular Culture in Pre-Service Teacher Education. In a society increasingly mediated by 21st century technologies, it is essential that educators embrace the entertainment culture that currently dominates public discourse. Through cell phones, television, movies, and internet sites, adolescents in particular are bombarded with images and the often discriminatory messages they contain related to race, class, gender, and sexuality. Once they enter college classrooms, they bring with them preconceived notions about the various groups that comprise society. As young scholars and teacher educators, we find that challenging our students to deconstruct and dissect popular imagery disarms their resistance to critical ways of regarding race, class, gender, and sexuality. This critical media literacy can also provide students with the understanding of the ways in which their identities are informed by popular culture and can help students learn to evaluate messages they receive from media for their social, political, economic, and aesthetic contents. Drawing on the works of James Loewen, Gloria Ladson Billings, Paulo Freire, Charles Lawrence, and Henri Giroux, we developed a course with a curriculum that acts as a framework to help university students critically examine the ways in which the dominant culture marginalizes minority populations. On one side, the framework provides students with readings that outline historical and contemporary arguments about racism, sexism, heterosexism, and classism in Western society. On the other side, the framework contains media products in which students can critically examine how social injustices permeate and are reinforced by popular culture. In the following section, we describe the nature of the course, the students' collective culture of resistance, and select aspects of critical pedagogy that serve as the pedagogical frame for our own teaching philosophies. Later, we explain why a course as important as this one still faces barriers preventing it from becoming an integral part of teacher education. Finally, reflecting on student response papers, evaluations, and teacher reflections, we reveal those pedagogical techniques that were the most successful in garnering student engagement. In this reflection, we found that popular texts like commercials and television shows, when coupled with academic tools like theory, enables students to better access the controversial material and to begin to understand teaching as a political act.
Course background. This paper presents our reflections as instructors for an undergraduate-level diversity course for teacher candidates at a Research One university that is both politically and socially conservative, and where the majority of students are whites and middle class. The course is required for all education majors, but each section typically includes students from various other disciplines. Each class section has a maximum of 40 students, and in all cases, white women majoring in early childhood education or elementary education were the overwhelming majority. Each year, a supervising professor chose a cohort of graduate students to teach the 8 sections of the course. The Division of Curriculum and Instruction, where the course was housed, viewed this class as a pedagogical project with dual benefits. On one hand, it served as a forum for pre-service teachers to explore issues of diversity and possible strategies for social action in their classrooms in an increasingly heterogeneous society. On the other hand, graduate students were charged to design syllabi, locate course readings, and craft and present lectures to the class. As scholars training for the professoriate, we viewed this class as the perfect opportunity to explore our teaching philosophies, develop our own pedagogical styles, and garner necessary classroom experience in dealing with difficult yet critically important topics. In meetings during the summer months, the instructors often traded ideas on the best readings, lecture notes, and guest speakers so that each section, while unique, meets and exceeds an identical set of course objectives. Our cohort of teachers included instructors from diverse cultural and educational backgrounds. We are no different. One of us, Jamie Patrice, is a 33-year-old white woman who was raised in Phoenix, Arizona, and attended predominantly white Catholic schools. The other, Erica Nicole, is a 27-year-old black woman who was raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and attended predominantly black inner-city schools. Both of us are PhD candidates studying social and philosophical foundations of education, but differ in our areas of focus. Jamie is currently studying identity performance among children and youth living on the streets, while Erica is studying urban schools and narrative. Our use of the visual in classroom stems from Jamie's background in fine arts and her use of visual in research, while our inclination towards the incorporation of popular culture stems from Erica's research on racist and sexist imagery in contemporary media products, such as hip-hop lyrics and music videos. Together, we developed a syllabus that engaged students in a semester-long critique of visual images and how they promote hegemonic notions about race, class, gender, and sexuality. Our aim as instructors in this course is to, together with students, critically analyze hegemonic structures of whiteness, heteronormativity, patriarchy, xenophobia, and privilege, and how such practices can lead to unequal educational outcomes in K-12 schools. The course objectives taken directly from our syllabus include the following. 1. Explore the complexity and multiplicity of one's own cultural identities and the roles played within a society of diverse cultural, linguistic, racial, gender, socioeconomic identities. 2. Examine power relations, privilege, and oppression in a society in general and schools particularly. 3. Examine constructions within society of so-called appropriate knowledge in education and the effect those values have placed on children and people in general from diverse backgrounds. 4. Use knowledge of the history and foundations of education and the societal and social histories of those typically underrepresented in schools to determine the appropriate use of content, methods, and technology in increasing educational opportunity for all children. And 5. Actively participate in challenges to the continuation of oppression. A course with the above objectives is not unique to this university. Many schools around the country require that future teachers include multicultural or diversity education in their programs of study. This is because, and many scholars agree, that teaching in American schools requires expertise in at least three areas: content, teaching skills, and disposition. In other words, teachers must know what to teach and they must know how to teach. And they must understand how to transform their classrooms into culturally relevant, democratic learning environments. This last skill hinges on the idea that to support democracy, educators must eliminate disparities in educational opportunities among all students, especially those who have been poorly supported by our current system. The first step, however, is for educators to acknowledge that inequities exist and that schools often reinforce those inequities for those students. More specifically, the academic and hidden curricula of American schooling don't always recognize the cultures and backgrounds of all students. Instead, students who are from minority groups often feel alienated and often have disproportionately higher failure and dropout rates as a result. Clearly, researchers recognize the importance of creating an equitable classroom environment. This can be particularly challenging in heterogeneous environments, like many of today's classrooms, where children come to school from various social and cultural backgrounds. Classes like this diversity course, therefore, are essential in preparing teachers to educate our children. In this case, the majority of our teacher candidates are white women from affluent families who are training to enter schools in a state with students from diverse backgrounds, including immigrant students, refugees from Central Africa and the Middle East, homeless children, and students from various racial and ethnic backgrounds. In some districts, the majority of students speak languages other than English in the home. Classes like this course, therefore, are essential in preparing teachers to educate all of our children. Creating an inclusive learning environment, while increasingly difficult, is essential for the learning of all K-12 students. In their investigation of inclusive learning environments, Jordan, Schwartz, and McGee Richmond found that teachers' epistemological beliefs greatly inform the ways in which they understand their responsibility for creating inclusive classroom environments. They further argue that teacher experiences in the first year of teaching do little to challenge or change these beliefs, and therefore the burden lands on teacher preparation to incorporate a multicultural and diversity focus. As Howard, McGee, Schwartz, and Purcell argue, unstated beliefs can become explicit if teachers are provided the opportunity to reflect on these beliefs, discuss them, and be challenged by feedback from both colleagues and peers. Once made explicit, teachers can then begin to critically examine their own beliefs and how these beliefs influence their desire in creating an inclusive learning environment. Furthermore, the stereotypical opinions teachers hold about a student's ability to learn undoubtedly expand or limit the student's possibilities for achievement, as these judgments are often directly informed by their professional preparation. It is important for teacher educators to articulate and reflect on the assumptions that inform beliefs about human abilities and diversity, as well as how they are communicated in initial teacher education. While fully aware that they must know what to teach and how to teach, most of the future teachers who enroll in this course are unaware that their own ideas about gender, sexuality, American history, race, and culture have a significant impact on their classrooms and their students' learning. It is thus imperative that pre-service teachers critically assess the ways in which they view the world and understand others. We also acknowledge that though we are instructors in the classroom, we must also continuously reflect on our own biases, privilege, and behavior as authority figures. We therefore chose readings, discussion topics, and assignments based on aspects of critical pedagogy. Our framework for using critical pedagogy has two influences. First, we draw on the work of Paulo Freire and others as we establish a community-based learning atmosphere. A chief component of this community learning environment is the use of co-teaching, where students take part in the dissemination and examination of information. Second, we draw on the work of critical race scholars like Charles Lawrence as we strive to understand contemporary racism as an institutionalized phenomenon. In order to make institutionalized racism more visible, we investigate the personal stories of people who are victimized by American institutions. In his important text, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Freire explains that conventional schooling relies on the teacher transmitting information to students, including ideology, while the students passively receive that information as truth. During assessments, such as standardized tests and papers, the students aren't asked to present their analysis or interpretation of the material. Rather, they must demonstrate mastery of the information through regurgitation. This practice, known as banking education, creates an intellectual and authoritative polarity between the students and the teachers. In other words, the student knows nothing and the teacher knows all. In societies like the U.S., where there is a highly structured social hierarchy, this banking system is particularly problematic because it reinforces the ideology of dominant groups. For example, in typical American history courses, the mission of the explorers, settlers, and pioneers are presented as virtuous, patriotic, and courageous. Students whose ancestors were casualties of American colonization are not expected to question these stories. They must retain passive and accept these myths as truth. Incidentally, this means they must also accept that their second-class positions in contemporary society are in fact normal. Freire argues that the banking system should be replaced with a critical problem-posing pedagogy. In this framework, teachers and students work together to create a learning environment in which both are simultaneously teaching and learning. Furthermore, he argues that progressive educators must respect the knowledge their students bring to the conversation and understand that they know their situation better than anyone else. One result of critical problem-posing education is that students eventually learn to question the ideologies of the privileged. Over time, scholars have applied and extended Freire's ideas and research about the best ways to prepare teachers for service in the classroom. In 2003, Gay and Kirkland found that teacher candidates should engage critically reflective teaching when working with diverse student populations. Their suggestions include reflecting on one's privilege and including the perspectives of people from various backgrounds in educational training. Although we, as instructors of this course, do not apply one singular branch of critical pedagogy, we do highlight the importance of reflecting on, discussing, and critically examining one's personal experiences while simultaneously listening to and hearing the voices of those traditionally excluded, ignored, or marginalized by dominant culture.
This course in context. Unfortunately, a course like this one, that encourages teachers to investigate their own privileges and epistemologies about students and learning, does not always fit well into the changing cultures of teaching and teacher preparation. Even though there is consistent agreement among scholars that a culturally relevant pedagogy is an effective means of increasing the engagement and achievement of all students, there still exists an increasing desire for a movement towards reliable and proven methodologies. With this movement comes the expectation that this course will teach pre-service teachers what to teach and how to teach it, particularly to students who are not like them. This course, however, is not a methods course, and it is not directly tied to a practicum or student teaching. We offer no formulas or strategies or even guidelines for teaching students who are different from us. Instead, we ask our students to critically analyze the lens through which they view the world. Given the pressure to master their subject area, to learn behavior management, and to learn how to develop lesson plans, the course, which is much more theoretical in its focus, is often viewed as peripheral, irrelevant, and an unnecessary distraction. There are other barriers that we have encountered in developing a course such as this one. In fact, at our own university, we have seen this course deteriorate from an upper division, theoretically driven course dissecting issues of race, class, and gender, to a lower division course that is moving towards a standardized syllabus across sections and that rejects the incorporation of theory. The current sentiment is that students are uninterested in theory and its implications. Furthermore, the standardization movement creeps into the university classroom as some faculty argue for the use of one consistent textbook, less challenging theory, and fewer reading assignments across all sections. The primary barriers to this course and other multicultural education courses are, however, the mandates of the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. On its face, NCLB proposes that teachers and schools are held accountable for closing the achievement gap that exists between the wealthy and poor student and between white and minority students. This is a relevant and seemingly progressive initiative. NCLB does not, however, acknowledge, as we would, that the achievement gap is a partial result of generations of structural discrimination, institutionalized racism, classism, and heterosexism. As mentioned above, scholars of culturally relevant and anti-racist pedagogies find that teaching is a political act, and that classrooms can either be used to promote or hasten social justice. While NCLB does not deny that teacher candidates should learn and explore strategies to close the achievement gap, it does not mandate courses like this one, which propose that teachers deliberately address the social and political diversity between their students. This leaves the students wondering how a class like this one matters in their ultimate goal to close the achievement gap. There has also been wide criticism of the one-size-fits-all doctrine of No Child Left Behind. In short, if schools cannot prove that their students are achieving based on standardized tests, they receive harsh sanctions from the federal government, including reduced funding and, in the worst cases, closure. This is regardless of the social and economic disparities that may affect student achievement in that community. As a result of the socially blind application of the policy, many schools have resorted to reducing or eliminating activities, classes, and even whole programs that don't review information that will be featured on the standardized test. Given the constraints of the NCLB era, it may be an unfair expectation that teachers critically examine the social structures at play that contribute to the achievement gap. How can they justify spending instruction time on lessons that promote inclusion and equitable learning if No Child Left Behind won't concur that such lessons can promote improved achievement for all students? Critical analysis of popular myth. We find beginning the course from a historical perspective that demythologizes American history is essential for several reasons. First, it introduces our intent to demystify celebrated eras in American history, namely settlement, westward expansion, and civil rights. Secondly, it illustrates the ways in which racism, privilege, and heteronormativity are institutionalized in the very foundations of American society. In order to present this more inclusive version of American history, we rely on historians such as Joel Spring and James Lowen. We also learn to look more critically at representations of history and historical texts and begin to question the reasons why the teaching of American history continues to be approached from a Eurocentric perspective within the context of K-12 education. We do this through the examination of editorials authored by Benjamin Franklin, children's books on the discovering of the Americas, and the first Thanksgiving, and by sharing with our students Confederate artifacts and images that glorify slavery. For example, Beyond Face Value is a visual historical project that catalogs and thematically characterizes Confederate money, depicting the images of slavery and slaves. Through the work of visual scholars like Eric Margolis, we also include typically underrepresented perspectives on the Indian education movement, for example, and the creation of Indian schools as a means of cultural extermination and assimilation. Popular culture and the visual image. Contemporary popular culture is steeped in visual images, the entertainment industry being one of the principal architects of these images. These images translate messages to their viewers, and whether we agree to it or not, they affect how we view and understand the world. Popular culture and the media serve as two of the chief educators of our students. Therefore, as future classroom teachers, undergraduate students need opportunities to consider how the media influence their own lives before they can begin to appreciate the need to teach critical media literacy to their students. In order to reach students, it is essential to engage them with the texts of everyday life, with media and popular culture, so as to understand how these discourses structure the knowledge they bring to the classroom. Therefore, we argue that it is not only ineffective to attempt to resist the entertainment culture that dominates public discourse in contemporary society, but perhaps even detrimental to do so. Furthermore, we maintain that popular culture educates us on the ways in which we should view one another and how we understand ourselves and our place in society. Popular culture helps us to determine what is normal, what is abnormal, what behaviors are acceptable, and what behaviors are not. Take, for example, recent reality shows like Beauty and the Geek, A Shot at Love with Tila Tequila, and The Man Show. Each of these shows suggests that when distilled to their essential elements, women are objects without reason, and men are hyper-sexualized and emotionless. These may seem like unimportant guilty pleasures that have no effect on how we view gender roles, but Michael Kimmel, leading scholar of masculinity, argues that media, particularly recent movies targeted to young male audiences, correctly depict the changing tide in gender roles and relations. The growing traditions of heterosexism, delaying of marriage until one's late 20s, and the general extension of adolescence over the last 50 years are all just as evident in television and movies as they are in social statistics. Therefore, popular television shows, movies, and magazine advertisements, when coupled with theoretical texts, can be essential aids in discussions surrounding critical issues like those taught in this course. For example, clips from YouTube.com of comedian Christopher Titus issuing a comedic apology for the many ways European settlers oppressed non-whites in the New World, or of President Bush calling then-presidential candidate Barack Obama articulate, proved to be ideal in stimulating conversations about race and a means of concretely illustrating theories like unconscious racism. We examine mainstream television commercials for popular candy bars and clips from Hollywood blockbusters that are steeped in homophobic sentiments to augment lesson plans about heteronormativity. In the sections that follow, we outline three examples in depth and discuss the ways in which they have proven effective in breaking down student defenses and opening up the classroom to provide for meaningful and necessary conversations about race, class, gender, and sexuality. It is important to note that we do not suggest that the introduction of media products to the curriculum should take the place of traditional pedagogical tools, such as readings, lectures, discussions, and papers. As young scholars, we are often pressured to make our courses easier in terms of readings, assignments, and even the ways in which students access the readings. For example, magazine-like textbooks instead of texts, outlines instead of articles, movies instead of readings, etc. Many claim that because the students have become so dependent on media and technology, for example, cell phones, television, social networking sites, and text messaging, that forcing them to engage in the rigors of theory at the undergraduate level is an unrealistic expectation. Some may also feel that because high schools are so narrowly focused on high-stakes test preparation, that our commitment to various traditional methods is foreign and unfair to the students in our classroom. During this reflective exercise, we argue that there are ways to merge the strengths of innovative technologies and traditional pedagogies in the design of courses that are both current and relevant, but also challenging and useful.
Gender. One of the topics we focus on over the course of a semester is gender identity. We begin by helping students understand the difference between sex and gender. Beginning with this differentiation enables us to deepen and expand our discussions into topics of sexuality and heteronormativity. Now we present a theory when it comes to wealth, status, and power, men are the dominant gender in our society. We also offer as evidence census data that prove women on average only make about 80 cents for every dollar a man makes for the same job. Then it is our job as a class to theorize just how and why a gender binary exists, and if it is genetics or environment that teaches us how to be boys or girls. As sociologists, we explain to our students that the theory that gender is socially and culturally constructed and how we argue this construction begins as early as conception. For example, parents choosing masculine or feminine names and preparing an appropriate rearing environment, for instance, nursery colors and decorations and gender-appropriate toys, etc. Once the students have completed the readings, engaged in lectures and classroom discussions, we provide two television commercials as evidence of artificially constructed gender identity and the problematics of this gender binary. The Rose Petal Cottage, created by Hasbro, came to market in spring of 2008, and its commercial purported to deliver the dream of every young girl, a fold-up, life-size playhouse, which comes with a variety of accessories at additional costs, including an oven and a washer and dryer. The commercial comes in two versions, both of which can be found on YouTube.com, one geared for children and the other for mothers. In the version for mothers, Hasbro boasts the Rose Petal Cottage is a place of her very own where she can decorate. Here, the viewer is presented with an image of a young girl rearranging furniture in her cottage, saying, "This goes here," where she can contain her imagination. Then we see the child saying, "Time to do laundry." Maintaining the Rose Petal Cottage is where her dreams have room to grow. The version made for children appears far more confident in its assertion of what a young girl's dream is and should be. In the commercial, a girl sings, "Rose Petal Cottage, a place of my very own," and, "I love when my laundry gets so clean, clean, clean. Taking care of my home is a dream, dream, dream." We find that these 30-second commercials are ideal tools to teach not only media literacy, but to examine the ways in which society and culture construct for us what it means to be a girl. We then look to popular media, including the examples mentioned above of Beauty and the Geek, The Man Show, as well as Disney feature films, particularly those highlighted by Henry Giroux, including The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. In his discussion of these films, he argues that the storylines and the animation promote ideas about gender that reinforce harmful opinions about femininity and masculinity. He points out, for instance, that both Belle and Ariel were animated to satisfy exaggerated beauty standards about body size and weight. Giroux also illustrates the shift in attitude that both heroines experience. In both cases, the princesses were initially characterized as rebellious, strong-willed teens that wanted nothing more than to leave the oppressive conditions of either home or community. Belle, for instance, read about faraway lands and claimed to want adventure in the great wide somewhere. Meanwhile, Ariel, the mermaid, wanted to be with people. She assumed that girls on land were bright young women, sick of swimming, ready to stand. At the end of both movies, however, the girls find true happiness in the arms and nearby homes of their princes. We find that pairing Giroux's discussion of Disney princesses like Ariel and Belle translates quite well to modern-day examples of gender expectations from popular culture. In the popular reality show The Bachelor, for example, 20 women compete to win the love of one man. And in the 2006 season, women competed for the affection of a real-life Prince Charming. We argue that by presenting the students with clips from media products, such as The Bachelor, we are more easily able to introduce often difficult discussions on the pervasiveness of the gender binary and provide students with the necessary tools to critically examine the problems introduced by this binary. One of the ways in which we normalize images from the media can be seen as young persons become more gendered and sexualized than before. We do not use the term sexualized to mean the same as sexually liberated, but rather features are exaggerated, smaller waists, and larger lips, behinds, and breasts. This assertion can be supported by evidence of the creation of tween lingerie. Tween is a term created to describe the age between childhood and adolescence, where young people are not quite teenagers and no longer children. Steadily increasing rates of plastic surgery in the U.S., particularly breast augmentation, also support this conclusion. While these commercials and movie and television clips are ideal teaching tools, it is essential that we couple media presentations with theory and engage both theory and media in classroom discussions. Upon viewing the Rose Petal Cottage ad, students can begin to understand that the desire to keep house, bake muffins, and be caregivers is not an inherent desire encountered in all persons of the female sex, and that these desires are created, in part, through cultural models that teach us to assume that the gender binary is natural. That is, the Rose Petal Cottage and commercial advertisements like the ones presented here reinforce the cultural belief that male children are naturally and exclusively masculine and female children are naturally and exclusively feminine. We therefore use this example to introduce and understand the work of Judith Butler as she problematizes the assumption of a common woman identity, for example. It reminds us that gender is reconstituted daily through the adoption, performance, and repetition of particular acts. From here, we are able to extend our discussion of gender into the damage that the gender binary can inflict on those who do not fit into our prescribed notion. The use of media and YouTube.com in particular bring text and images that students are already familiar with into the classroom and provides them with the space to begin to view them critically.
Heterosexism. After our discussion of gender construction, we turn our visions to sexuality and the ways in which the problematics of the gender binary lead into further problems with regards to how we view and understand sexuality in our society. We explore the hegemonic structures of heteronormativity that permeate our culture and find that the use of contemporary film, commercials, and print advertising is particularly helpful in engaging students in a critical discussion. One of the key media products that we use to stimulate our conversation of heteronormativity is the 2007 Snickers commercial that aired during halftime of that year's Super Bowl, which can also be found on YouTube.com. The commercial opens with two men in a mechanics shop leaning over the engine of a car. One of the men pulls a Snickers bar from his pocket, unwraps it, and places it in his mouth. The other man, so tempted by the chocolate-covered caramel, peanuts, and nougat, reaches over and begins to eat from the other end of the Snickers bar hanging from his friend's mouth. Lost in the ecstasy of the moment, Snickers apparently induces this ecstasy. Their lips meet. One man exclaims, "I think we just accidentally kissed," and the other responds, "Quick, do something manly." And both men proceed to pull out large chunks of their chest hair, screaming and howling in the process. After the laughter dies down, as many students find this particular scenario to be quite humorous, we begin to dissect the commercial to reveal the following. 1. Homosexuality is something to fear. And 2. Masculinity is synonymous with heterosexuality. As indicated previously, media help us to determine what is normal, what is abnormal, what behaviors are acceptable, and what behaviors are not. In this particular commercial, Snickers teaches us what it means to be a man, what behaviors are acceptable for men, and what behaviors are not. Homosexuality is frequently portrayed as accidental, perverse, and immoral on television. And while this commercial is no exception, it also presents homosexual behaviors as inherently negative and as something to fear. Disgusted that their lips have accidentally touched, the men immediately find it necessary to, quote, do something manly, suggesting that manliness or masculinity is inherently synonymous with heterosexuality. Commercials such as this demonstrate and promote heteronormativity, and this actualization transmits certain beliefs. There exist two sexes with two corresponding genders, and heterosexuality is assumed to be the only normal sexual orientation. Because of these assumptions, we learn, maintain, and reproduce beliefs about those who are non-heterosexual. These beliefs tend to hold non-heterosexuality as perverted, disturbed, or as a disease which should be cured, and further serve to maintain heterosexual persons in a dominant position. We use commercials such as these to introduce students to often difficult theories like symbolic violence, as coined by sociologist Pierre Bourdieu. Bourdieu argued that symbolic aspects of social relationships and social interactions are important in the repression of certain people, non-heterosexual people, or women, for example. He indicated that these symbolic representations, which present people in ways which compromise their best interests, serve to oppress these groups of people and are therefore symbolically violent. In other words, rather than using physical force, outlets such as media use symbolic violence to control certain groups. Therefore, commercial advertisements, like the Snickers commercial, that convey messages suggesting the perverse nature of homosexuality or that portray homosexuality as the antithesis of masculinity, are violent to the gay community. When we blend the Snickers commercial and others like it with a critical discussion on heteronormativity, it not only helps students to begin to critically examine the hegemonic structures serving to oppress minority groups in our society, but also provides a means of accessing difficult-to-understand theories like symbolic violence. Race. In this course, we approach the discussion of race in two parts. In the beginning of the semester, we review American history, particularly celebrated moments in colonization and expansion, from a critical race standpoint. That is, we encourage the students to incorporate the oppression of non-whites into their understanding of American history for two reasons. First, classes like this one offer students the chance to challenge the popular narrative of America as the democratic melting pot, where all of the world's outcasts sought and received refuge. That wasn't exactly true, for instance, for the natives who lived in the West for centuries. James Lowen's work, Lies My Teacher Told Me, explains the truer nature of European explorers and settlers' experiences in the New World. According to Lowen, his students were shocked to learn that what they had always known about pilgrims and Indians and the first Thanksgiving was mostly treasured American folklore. Second, it is important for students to know that racism wasn't the work of a few unique and now extinct private citizens. Rather, American policies depended on hierarchical rankings within society, and this was especially true of the relationship between Europeans and Africans. Most of our students are unaware that the federal government deliberately endorsed slavery, that the United States Supreme Court deliberately sanctioned segregation, and that the states outlawed marriages between whites and blacks. In order to illustrate the pervasiveness of racism and discrimination in American culture, we provide the students with historical and contemporary illustrations of oppression against non-whites. We chose photos of lynchings from withoutsanctuary.com, samples of Confederate money featuring slaves from the Beyond Face Value Project, and even examples of national and collegiate sports teams that use stereotypical images of Native Americans as mascots. In our experiences as instructors for this course, we have learned that one set of pictures, in particular, not only sparks discussion, but helps students to see how the American government was often complicit in hierarchical ranking of the races. Many of our students can define lynching, but few have any real understanding of the depths of its reaches within American history. Even fewer know the story of Emmett Till before our class discussion. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy lynched for allegedly whistling at a white woman. His murderers, who later admitted to the crime, were acquitted. Using three photographs, we walk our students through his story. His childhood photo, the front page of the newspaper with the headline, "Nation Shocked, Vow Action in Lynching of Chicago Youth," and a final image showing his mangled corpse at his funeral. His mother insisted on an open casket so the world could bear witness to the atrocities done to her son.
Students often engage the lessons on historical racism. Most are shocked and saddened by Till's story, but begin to resist its relevance when we discuss why a teacher would need to know such facts today. They ask questions like, doesn't the continued resurgence of discussions of race only reinforce the problem? Or, shouldn't we just leave the past in the past? They also use statements such as, my parents never used the N-word, so I know this doesn't apply to me. Critical race scholar Charles Lawrence explains that anyone born and raised in a society that was founded on racist principles and governed by racist laws is inherently, albeit unconsciously, racist. He goes on to explain that almost all of us have racist thoughts that can and eventually will, quote-unquote, slip out. When famous actor-turned-comedian Michael Richards responded to hecklers in 2007 by repeatedly calling them niggers during his stand-up comedy show, he let his own racist thoughts about blacks slip out, for example. Although Lawrence does not mention ideas about sexuality and religion, we find his argument is just as useful when attempting to understand Isaiah Washington's use of heterosexist slurs against fellow actor T.R. Knight and Mel Gibson's use of anti-Semitic and sexist slurs against arresting police officers. In order to supplement this discussion and to critique students' resistance against the notion of unconscious racism, we provide for discussion a PowerPoint presentation containing photos from theme parties hosted on well-known college campuses around the country. In each case, the partygoers were members of fraternities or sororities and dressed in accordance to the theme of the parties. For instance, at a prominent Texas university, the theme was South of the Border, supposedly in celebration of Cinco de Mayo. Students in the photographs dressed as landscapers and maids and had to cross a border at the front to enter the party. Their handwritten name tags read Pedro and Juan Carlos, and the name of their cleaning company was, quote, Spick and Span. We also show the students photos from a Halloween party at a prominent school in Alabama. In some cases, the students wore more traditional costumes, but many chose to dress in blackface, either as slaves or lynch victims. Others dressed as riot cops or Klansmen. We find these photos useful because they directly address the notion that the latest generation of Americans, college students who are educated to shame our past racist deeds, are free from racist thought or practices. The responses to the photos vary, but usually introduce to the class discussion one or more of three common arguments. First, many students ask, "What's so wrong with the parties? It was supposed to be funny." Second, many are disgusted as students in their age group would dress in blackface or write racist slurs about Mexicans on their costumes. Third, some become reflective. They admit to enjoying theme parties and wonder if they are as removed from the mistaken beliefs of past generations as they thought. Later in the semester, we introduce students to the notion of privilege and what it means to exist within American society with an indelible yet indiscernible assurance of comfort or accommodation. Peggy McIntosh's 1990 article on white privilege provides useful theoretical background on what privilege feels like. Like carrying an invisible knapsack of tools useful for full participation in society, and who has it? Her list of privileges, however, encourages the students to reflect on their own positions in society. As she admits that she can be late to a meeting and not have people blame it on her race, the students consider similar privileges in their own lives. Recently, most likely due to our election of an African-American president, many students have claimed that America is finally a truly post-racial society. With the readings from Joel Spring, Charles Lawrence, and Peggy McIntosh, students feel free to dismiss racism and even discrimination as artifacts of the past. That is why we work hard to demonstrate to the students that these scholars' observations are not outdated or based on personal experiences. The pictures from the theme parties where students demean and stereotype Mexican immigrants are a good start. Then we show students an advertisement from Sony for its PlayStation Personal. In this ad, a beautifully feminine but over-sexualized white woman is physically dominating an androgynously costumed black woman who is hidden in the shadows of the image. The caption for the ad reads, quote, "White is coming." This ad promoted the new PlayStation as unique because it was white. Most consoles on the market at that time were black. The advertisements were not released in the United States, but when civil rights leaders learned of the ads, they requested that Sony remove them. Sony complied. We also engaged the class in an in-depth discussion of Disney movies like Aladdin, which hyperbolized the differences between light and dark skin as representative of the eternal fight between good and evil. In order to demonstrate how systemic racism affects schools, we share episodes of The Oprah Winfrey Show, which illustrate apartheid education, as Jonathan Colzer describes it, over 50 years after the passing of Brown v. Board of Education. In order to show how racism is gendered, we show the critically acclaimed film, A Girl Like Me. It's a short film created by Keri Davis and presented at the Media That Matters Film Festival. This film relates the experiences shared by young black girls in a society dominated by hegemonic structures of whiteness and white beauty standards. The film can be viewed at MediaThatMatters.org. Presented with these contemporary texts, students can begin to question the notion that racism is a thing of the past. The theme parties, commercial advertisements, and the slippages of Hollywood superstars provide concrete examples to theory that will most likely otherwise remain inaccessible or perceived as irrelevant to their professional goals. Discussion and implications. For all intents and purposes, education in the U.S. is at an impasse. With No Child Left Behind in its eighth year, many of its promises are left unfulfilled. The achievement gap between white and minority students is not closed. The dropout rate is not decreased, and many still disagree on which skills define a highly qualified teacher. This may be because much of what currently occurs in the classroom is focused towards transmissionist knowledge acquisition with the intention of preparing students for standardized tests. Nelson therefore argues for the use of critical pedagogy, noting that a critical pedagogy is a liberating pedagogy, and critical thinking becomes a method by which a powerful education is enacted. Fostering critical thinking is essential to teacher preparation. Teacher candidates can begin to critically engage their world and the everyday texts that surround them in order to foster these critical thinking skills in their future students. Furthermore, teacher beliefs can become more sophisticated through a critical reflection about their own and their peers' teaching practices. As mentioned earlier, we align ourselves with those scholars who define the highly qualified teacher as one who knows what to teach, how to teach, and can act as an agent of social change for their students. Helping future teachers to understand teaching as a political act is essential in their transformation into agents of social change. Critical pedagogy and a genuine engagement with theory serve as necessary tools in this transformation. It is not our goal to usher students toward any one way of viewing the world. While we make no secret of the fact that we support democratic problem-posing pedagogies in K-12 classrooms, we maintain that it is important that our students have access to various lenses with which they can view the world. A critical pedagogy does just this. We argue that bringing the everyday text that students are continually exposed to into the classroom is an essential part of critical pedagogy. Media products such as film, commercial advertisements, music videos, and outlets such as YouTube.com are indispensable in fostering student engagement and in helping students to access difficult and controversial material. For example, students respond in teacher evaluations that, quote, the use of media was particularly helpful, or another quote, the instructor made the class interesting, especially with the media sources. Overall difficult, but a good class to take, end quote. In response to a question about what aspects of the course they liked, students responded, quote, the outside sources the professor used to facilitate discussion and the content was difficult, but the teacher made it easier and interesting. Comments such as this last one were not uncommon on teacher evaluations, and we attribute this frequent response to our instruction to the combined use of visual media and critical pedagogy. One student wrote, and I quote, at first I was overwhelmed and so apprehensive about what to expect throughout the whole semester. I definitely felt at times that the readings were daunting and challenging. However, I now feel they all had great significance. We do not believe that higher education classrooms should forego traditional pedagogical methods, such as readings, quizzes, lectures, and even tests. Rather, we argue that those educators who rely on traditional methods alone may not only lose the interest of their students, who are constantly influenced by popular culture, but they may also have difficulty proving the relevance of the course content. In our case, we challenged our students to read rigorous, controversial texts that some may consider inaccessible even at the college level. What we have found is that students, when challenged, rise to the occasion and find that theory, when coupled with media, is not only more accessible, but can be quite relevant.